Welcome to Exploration 1, Module 1, Part 2, and we will move on to some of the contents in Module 2. Before we get started, does anybody have any questions, queries from last week's lecture or any of the things that were presented last week before we get into the lecture proper? Alrighty, we'll take that as a no. And here we go. Now, last week we spoke about the fact that before we communicate, we need to use rules or protocols. The rules involved in telephone conversations are as important as the rules involved in network communication, which are important as the rules involved holding a dinner party, if you're into that sort of thing. And people assure me there are actually books you can buy on etiquette, and you can actually read up on what all these rules are, whether you set from the outside inwards and what sort of dessert forks you've got and all that sort of stuff. You can actually get a book on that. I've never seen one myself, but I'm sure they're out there. Okay, we consider an identified sender. We consider an agreed method of communication. We did cover this last week. Common language and grammar. And speed and timing of delivery. Confirmation and acknowledgement requirements. And that's how we decide how we're going to communicate a message. Generally speaking, you would communicate and have a different protocol of how you would communicate with, say, a four-year-old child than what you would communicate with an adult. I say generally because that's not always true, and sometimes it's easier to communicate with the four-year-old than it is with the adult. We spoke about the fact that it depends on the number of messages that are on the communications channel, whether the message is being interfered with, or the level of noise, and what sort of quality of communications you've got, and we spoke about horrible VoIP. Now, I heard a rumour that the Optus network over here is moving completely towards voice over IP. And if that's true, I'm so not looking forward to it because it's going to sound horrible. Why must we be relegated to the quality of phone calls we had in the early 80s over satellite links in the year 2011? That's the question I would like to ask. I assume we've spoken previously about people have played with VoIP and people have played with Skype and those sorts of technologies and the apparent pitfalls that you can have when that happens. Your internal factors are your size of the message, the complexity of the message, the importance of the message. So if we're talking data communications, do we prioritise voice over IP over BitTorrent? Is the ability for you to ring your mum more important than your ability to download this week's season of Medium? I'm just looking down to the bits where we haven't covered this last week. Copper includes coaxial cable, fibre, radio waves, infrared or electromagnetic radiation, etc. Optical fibre, if you haven't seen it, are those thin strands of usually glass that contain light energy. You can get those Christmas trees that light up when you put light through them, obviously, and they've got optical fibres in them. Obviously, they're probably not data grade, but they give you all those pretty colours. As we said last week, TCP/IP is overall the most common protocol these days. Does anybody remember the days when we had IPX, SPX, NetBUI, DECnet, ARCNet, AppleTalk? A lot of that is changing and becoming simply stuff carried over TCP/IP. Can anybody tell me what happened at ARPA? What happened at, is it ARPA is the one I want, or ARIN? What recently happened as far as the allocation of IP addresses that is of some concern to the networking community? It happened in the last couple of weeks.
Ran out of addresses.
They assigned their last block of IPv4 addresses. Does anybody remember? Anybody remember hearing about that? It will be interesting to see if and when anybody moves towards IPv6, or whether we just keep sticking people behind more layers of network address translation. Most people would be aware that most operating systems these days ship with native IPv6 support. Actually, this is an interesting question. Has anybody ever got the IPv6 support under Windows to actually connect to something external, or has everybody just got the link local stuff going?
Never messed with
it. Fair enough.
Can that be found on XP, or is it just 7?
No, it's on XP, but you've got to go to the command prompt and go IPv6/install, and it adds the support in under XP.
Thank you, I'll try it out.
Okie dokie. Radio and television networks and stuff used to run on their own infrastructure, but that is being merged together and they run on their own, they run on common infrastructure. So you tend to find that radio stations now use the internet to shovel traffic around, and you find that there's lots of radio on the internet and voice over IP on the internet, and if I had a dollar for every blind person that had an internet radio station, I'd probably be richer than Gates. Okay, as we spoke last week, it needs fault tolerance, scalability, quality of service, and security. Scalability means you can add things into your network and upgrade the capacity of the network without necessarily adversely affecting the users, or with minimum impact on the users. So for example, you can go from 10 to 100 megabits per second. That shouldn't really affect anyone, but it will allow people to do those migrations without any huge problems. There are multiple links between points on the internet. It's not a true mesh, because with a true mesh, every node would be connected to every other node, but it is a partial mesh, and we do have multiple redundant bandwidth paths that will allow traffic to travel from one point to another. Security is very important. Nobody wants their bank account details leaking out. Nobody wants people using FireSheep in the airport to nick off with your Facebook login credentials, or your Gmail login credentials, or whatever else that happens to be traveling around. And this brings up an interesting point. If you are on an open Wi-Fi network, such as we have them at McDonald's, I believe America has them at Starbucks, I think we have them at Starbucks as well, I'm not sure where else you get open Wi-Fi. Airports often have Wi-Fi networks that you can pay to use. Be very careful and make sure you have sufficient network protection to save you from any grief that you may experience if you are on one of these open networks. Turn your firewall on. Don't do anything over that network that's sensitive unless you're VPNing out to somewhere else. We played with a system a month or so ago called Witopia.net, which allows you to get a protected VPN connection, and you can then masquerade as though you're coming from whichever country in the world you like, which is useful for Pandora if you are not in the States, or other geo-locked services, such as Hulu, I think is another one. Any questions before we continue? Any comments? Okay, there are two types of networks that we generally deal with. There are circuit-switched networks and there are packet-switched networks. If you remember the old telephone exchanges, you had lots of wires, you had lots of loops, and you had a telephone exchange that was responsible for connecting circuits from one to the other. So if you dialed up your next door neighbour, the telephone exchange would be responsible for allocating a circuit, and it would do the necessary connections to connect you to your next door neighbour, and you guys could chat about what you wanted, and then when you finished the call, the circuit would be broken. It's worth mentioning that the problem with this is if you get a fault in the network or something goes wrong on the circuit between you and the destination, the call drops and has to be re-established. A packet switch network divides data into multiple blocks or multiple pieces, they could be called blocks, and each of these pieces is encapsulated, and depending on which layer of the OSI reference model we're talking about, encapsulated means wrapped up. It's a funky word for with something else wrapped around it. And these packets of information are sent across the network, and they can be sent over multiple and varying routes. So not all packets have to travel the same way every time. And in fact, packets can go out one way and come in a different way. A classic example of that, does anybody remember the old satellite systems where your downstream was 400 kilobits per second, but your upstream was a dial-up modem? Has anybody ever seen those? Okie dokie, I'll take that as a no. Is anyone still awake, by the way?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, just checking. Believe me, there have been times when I've been rabbiting on for 5 minutes and nobody's actually hearing me, and it's kind of funny, but not very productive. Okie dokie. So the packets can be rerouted to travel via different links to get to their destination. Now, the packets actually contain addressing information. Can anybody tell me what is the name of the addressing information on a TCP/IP network? What would be the address that those packets would contain, generally speaking? This is not a trick question. Okay, the address I'm talking about is the IP address. And most packets have a source IP address and a destination IP address. And we will cover lots more about IP addresses in Module 3. Packets also have a sequence number, so that can be reassembled. And that is important because if you are going to send packets over multiple different paths, they can be delivered out of order. So packet 1 can turn up, packet 6 can turn up, packet 4 can turn up, packets 2 and 3 can then turn up, and then 5 can turn up. So it's very important that if you are using a protocol that it has sequence numbers so that the stream of data can be reassembled in a meaningful way.
What happens if one of the packets...
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Ahead, sorry.
What happens if a packet is lost?
That depends on the protocol. If you are using TCP, which is a transmission control protocol, TCP guarantees end-to-end reliability. So if a packet is lost, there is a timer that expires and the packet is retransmitted. And there are all sorts of algorithms to make sure that those retransmission timers don't fill the network up with bandwidth. So TCP does its best option to retransmit the packet and make sure that it gets to the destination and all of those packets are actually acknowledged. If you, however, look at UDP, that is a fire and forget mechanism, and it's up to the other higher level protocols to handle the retransmission. So say, for example, you perform a DNS query on www.qcat.org, and the first packet gets dropped by a router, the DNS resolver is then responsible for retrying that query a number of times with a particular timeout to try and get the answer to that DNS query.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. Quality of service. Okay, well, you'd think this was pretty simple, but there are ways of actually categorizing the quality of service you're going to get. In the DiffServe model of quality of service, you have classes of traffic, gold, silver, and bronze. You also have high throughput, low latency, high throughput, high latency, and various other indicators that talk about the sort of traffic that you are going to get. So to take our example further, it doesn't really matter if your BitTorrent is delayed a bit, as long as, or web pages are delayed a bit, as long as email comes down in a timely fashion and, say, voice over IP applications function. If the demand for network services exceeds the carrying capacity, devices can queue packets in memory, but once they've queued a certain number of packets in memory, if you try to queue more packets, the device will simply drop those packets, which is what we were just talking about. That can cause delays if you're queuing packets. And for anybody who's ever done voice over IP over a satellite link, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. There is quite a round-trip delay, sometimes of up to 2 or 3 seconds, which makes conversations somewhat a challenge. Okay, security is important. Loss of data, theft of intellectual property, loss of funds, all things that are pretty serious problems in the business world. And loss of business confidence. How would you feel if you banked with a bank that wrote everybody's credit number, card numbers on bits of paper that were lying around on the front counters of the bank so that anybody who walked in could see all the different credit card numbers? Obviously, you know, that wouldn't be a good thing to have happen. Physical security is important. You need to secure devices to prevent tampering. We were discussing here possibly bringing in laptops to use in at the academy here. However, we were certainly looking at ways of securing those laptops so that somebody didn't walk away with them. So obviously, yeah, that's physical security. You need to ensure confidentiality, and you need to maintain data integrity. You need to make sure that the data came from who you thought it came from. I'm sure everybody remembers the Melissa virus and 100 other email worms that have been bouncing around ever since. The ones from Disneyland telling them that you're going to win a holiday, the ones from Microsoft telling them that you're going to win a holiday, the ones from Apple that tell you you're going to win 6 iPads and a cruise in the Caribbean, perhaps are not from the organization in question. I sometimes get some emails from some very nice people in Nigeria that are offering me hundreds of thousands of dollars if I could just carry out something for them. Sadly, I have yet to be able to take them up on their kind offer. And for anybody who's not currently on lecture, the last 10 seconds of dialogue was exceedingly sarcastic. If you're ensuring that the data came from the sender, you will tend to use hash algorithms and digital signatures and those sorts of methods. CRCs can do error checking. That stands for cyclic redundancy check. We don't really go into how they work because they are a little bit complex and rather mathematical. But if you look them up on the net, there's lots of information. You need to ensure availability so that users can do their work. It's no point if the accounting system can't function because 6 people are on Facebook. Trends. There's some overall trends listed here. Increased number of mobile users. Now, has anybody seen that, I think in the States at least, AT&T is now capping people at 5 gig of mobile data?
I think they had an unlimited plan before.
Do that too. They did have unlimited and then they switched it. So if you were lucky enough to be signed up, you got grandfathered in, but...
And that won't hold out forever, because one of the things that they don't really want lots of people to know is that their mobile infrastructure is in danger of not being able to carry the amount of data that is being shoveled over the networks by all of these fandangled iPhones and Android phones and Nokia phones and 3G netbooks and all these people that are now using mobile data when they are out and about. But it is a problem. If you've never been subjected to volume charging before, you get pretty grumpy when you have to actually keep an eye on how much you download. Even if there is a tool that will tell you, or a usage meter or whatever, people generally don't like being limited on using a particular resource. I'm really going to go through and fix this stupid sensitivity after lecture because it's still messed up.
You're not cutting out too much every...
Yeah, I am. I can hear cutting out.
I don't hear any.
But yeah, maybe that's what I'm saying.
It's on the edge, though. It's sort of going pop, 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 pop. And whilst it's at the end of the actual sentences and stuff, it's right after I speak. Stop talking. If I talk quietly, then it'll eventually... See, if I talk quietly, I've got to keep my voice up. Otherwise, it'll take me out. More network devices. Okay, how many things don't have a network port these days? In fact, set-top boxes have got network ports. There are certain fridges that have got network ports. Some electricity meters have network ports, or Bluetooth communications so that you can interrogate how much power you're using, and all those sorts of nifty things. And that is the end of Chapter 1. Does anybody have any questions, queries, before we wander on to opening up Chapter 2's notes? Okie dokie. Just give me a second, guys. I'm actually looking for the Module 2 notes, which seem to have disappeared, which is somewhat disturbing. It's disappeared out of my Dropbox.
We're all afflicted by Dropbox demons.
Yeah, this one might be my fault, but I just can't see how it would have been, because I actually saw them in there last week. Which is why I'm always telling people not to run your life on Dropbox. Alright, well, I'm going to have to make it up. That's not much fun. Because I'd written those notes out, and they ain't there. Alright, we're making it up. Chapter 2 basically deals with the bits and pieces that discuss layered models and how we look at protocols. So we first of all talk about layered models, and we next of all talk about the two different models, the OSI reference model and the TCP/IP reference model. And we then talk about the different layers that exist in those models as an overview. Now, what you're essentially dealing with is a layered model breaks the functions that a protocol performs into logical units that allows you to change various aspects of the protocol without changing all of the functionality that exists in the network stack. So, for example, if you're using Ethernet, you can change Ethernet to run over wireless. You can change Ethernet to run over... Ethernet to run over copper cable, or you can run certain in forms of Ethernet over infrared. So you can change the physical media without changing the protocols that are above the physical media. Now, there are two types of models. There are reference models, and there are protocol models. And a reference model is designed so that you can compare protocols, and the actual protocol models often have less layers and actually map the functions of the protocols. The reason we have a difference between the reference model and the protocol model is that not all protocols require the complexity of a reference model, but a reference model does give us the ability to benchmark what sort of things differ between various protocols. There are basically two network models that we deal with in day-to-day stuff. There is the TCP/IP reference model, and sorry, there's a TCP/IP model, I should say, which is a protocol model, and there is the OSI reference model. The reason we use a layered model of protocols is to show how all of the protocols interact. So, for example, if we picture a sponge cake, which is always my favorite image because I love sponge cake, and at the bottom layer you have the plate, and then you have the spongy stuff, which is the bottom of the cake, the bottom layer of the sponge cake. You then have the jam, and you then have the cream, and you then have the sprinkles on the top, just as an example. That is the layered model of the sponge cake. And to cut yourself a piece of the sponge cake, you're going to have to take the knife. It's going to have to cut through the sprinkles layer, the cream layer, the jam layer, and the sponge layer until it gets down to the plate, which obviously we don't slice up, but yeah, it's just an analogy. Anybody got any questions on that apart from where can I get a yummy piece of sponge cake because we can't help you with it?
Are there actually other sort of day-to-day in-use reference models besides OSI?
I think there was once, but the OSI reference model seems to have supplanted all of the other ones. It tends to have taken over all the other ones. Back in the 80s, when they were designing these reference models, they actually did have some alternative ones, but the OSI became popular. Okie dokie. So, if we look at the TCP/IP model first of all, it is a four-layer model. And if you're doing ITE1 and you're doing the final in ITE1, you will need to know that the four layers of the TCP/IP model are the network access layer, the network layer, the transport layer, and the application layer. And that will be the answer to one of your questions in the ITE1 final. Let's take these layers one at a time, because that's usually the best way to take them. Now, I usually work from bottom up when I discuss these models. So the bottom layer of the TCP/IP protocol model is the network access layer. It concerns itself with the functions that are going to explain how the network is accessed. Are we using point-to-point protocol? Are we using Ethernet? Are we using optical fiber? Are we using wireless? Exactly what mechanism is going to transfer these packets from one end to the other? TCP/IP doesn't usually care about how packets get from source to destination as long as they do. The only parameter that is usually set for the network access layer is a thing that we call the maximum transmission unit, and that is the largest datagram that is allowed to travel over a particular communications channel. So if you are using ADSL, you'd be looking at 1492 bytes or 1460 bytes, or depending on how your equipment is configured. And we discussed last year in exploration that if you had an MTU problem on your ADSL, little things would work, say for example SSH and Telnet, but the connections would lock up if you tried to view a big web page. It's probably also worth mentioning that in certain specific situations, for example, if you are on noisy links or unreliable links, it can be actually advantageous to reduce the maximum transmission unit so that you get more smaller packets through than fewer larger packets. However, in today's modern internet, you shouldn't need to be pulling those sorts of tricks too often. Okie dokie, so we have the network access layer. The network layer is responsible for the addressing. It is responsible for routing the packets from one place to another using whatever routing rules that we're going to use in TCP, which we will talk about in a future module. But they are responsible making sure that the packets from my machine get to the Ventrilo server in Perth, which then relays them back to you guys over in the US and Canada and Africa and wherever you may happen to. Now, the routing is usually handled at this layer, and it's usually there are various protocols that can make sure that that routing automatically happens or it is done manually. Now, if we look at the next layer up, we have the transport layer. It is responsible for fragmenting the data stream into segments. It is responsible for sequencing those segments. If using TCP, it is responsible for error detection and packet retransmission. And it's also responsible for handling the aspects of windowing. Now, we don't go into windowing too much, but basically what a window does is it allows a certain number of packets to be sent without acknowledgement. And then as the acknowledgements come back for the packets that have been received, more packets are sent, which is called a sliding window. And they do this so that if you are on a link that has high delay, you can have, say, 5, 10, 15 packets in flight, and then as the packets are acknowledged, you can then put more packets into your buffer, and it ensures a smooth transfer of packets, because if you are acknowledging each packet on a network that had a 1.5 second round trip time, you would seriously reduce the throughput on your network. Anybody got any questions so far? Alrighty. The application layer is the layer on the TCP model that basically takes the information from the applications and is responsible for... Oh, transport layer also handles port numbers. It handles multiplexing multiple different communications protocols on the same network connection, so Telnet, web, SMTP, etc., and that sort of thing. So the application layer is responsible for taking the data from the application, packaging it up, and pushing it down to the transport layer, which is then responsible for beginning the process of sending the data over the network. So as we can see, in a layered model, all packets need to travel through all layers from the top all the way down to the bottom. So it starts at the application layer, the transport layer, the network layer, the network access layer, and then it goes through, and then at the other end it goes network access layer, network layer, transport layer, application layer. Any confusion or stuff on any of that? Alright, I'll assume not. Obviously, by the end of module 2 or 3, I will expect you all to know the layers of the TCP/IP model and the layers of the OSI reference model. So, however you want to memorize something, if you want to do jump rope and learn it that way, or if you want to braille them out and read them a few times, or play them on a tape recorder while you're asleep, we'd like you guys to know these layers and preferably a little bit about what they do. For anybody who's been through this question course before, you will be aware that there are questions in the test that ask you what all the different layers are and what they do. And it is important in this network fundamental course to understand what the different layers do and what functions they perform. Okie dokie. OSI reference model has 7 layers. Can anybody give me a couple of them? Starting from the bottom, perhaps. Anybody remember any of these layers from last year, or does anyone just happen to know them?
Your acronym was actually very helpful. See if I can do the 7 in order. Physical... Of course, now what I'm trying to do it. Physical transport... No, that's not the right order.
Data link? Data link?
Yeah, physical data link.
Starts with N.
Network transport session presentation and application.
Well done! Well done! You get the lollipop for today. Please do not throw sausage pizza away. Physical data link network transport session presentation application. If you want to go the other way, all people seem to need data processing, or Australia Post sucks, they never deliver parcels. Okay? Whichever one works for you. Application, presentation, session, transport, data link, network. Oh, sorry, I got them around the wrong way. Application, session, application, presentation, session. Mate, I've really got it bad today. Transport, network, data link, physical. So they are the 7 layers of the OSI reference model. And it just goes to show that I know them forwards better than I know them backwards. This is a 7-layer reference model that you use for comparing one protocol to another. You use it for contrasting the different features of various protocols, and you use it for breaking down the functions of what the different protocols and functions they need to perform. Okay, so at the bottom we have the physical layer, which is responsible for the physical communications media. Are we using wires? Are we using fiber? Are we using copper, wireless? What are we doing? What sort of voltages are we dealing with? What sort of electrical considerations are we dealing with? How do we get the bits across this particular medium? This is the physical layer. The next layer above the physical layer is the data link layer. The data link layer is responsible for a few things. It's responsible for grouping bits together into what we call frames. Now, each of these things that I'm talking about, such as bits, frames, packets, segments, and data, are what we call a protocol data unit, or a PDU. And most layers of the OSI reference model have a PDU for them. So at layer 1, which is the physical layer, we have bits. At layer 2, we have frames. And believe me, this will be in your test. So you have bits, frames, packets, which is at layer 3, segments at layer 4, and data at layer 7. Any questions on that so far? Alrighty, so the data link layer concerns itself with framing the data, putting the data into frames. It concerns itself with error detection and possible... So for example, your CRCs and stuff tend to happen at your data link layer. The data link layer is actually broken into 2 sub-layers, but we won't talk about that until we talk about Ethernet. The data link layer tends to use... The addresses at the data link layer tend to be MAC addresses, which are a 48-bit quantity that is unique to each device. Generally, the first 24 bits are the organizational unique identifier, which is how you can figure out who made the network card or the Bluetooth device or whatever. And the other 24 bits are assigned randomly by the manufacturer. Now, there are a number of ways of writing MAC addresses, but the most common one that I tend to see is six hexadecimal numbers, six two-digit hexadecimal numbers separated by colons. So 00 colon 00 colon 1b colon 1d colon 28 colon 36 would be an example of a MAC address. Has anyone not seen a MAC address? They're used in Bluetooth, they're used in Ethernet, they're used in a lot of... Alrighty. The network layer is responsible for addressing. It's a bit like the network layer in the TCP/IP model. If we compare the TCP/IP model and the OSI reference model, layers 1 and 2 can be considered the network access layer of the TCP/IP model, and level 3 is the network layer, and it is about comparable between the two models. How you doing? I'm well. The second one from the corner. Ian will catch up with you at some point. He's in this morning. Okay, so I'll just get back to this lecture. The network layer is essentially the same between the two models. And you're looking at the addressing information. You're looking at the IP addresses and those sorts of things, and the actual routing functions and stuff like that to get data from one place to another. The next layer above the network layer is the transport layer. The transport layer is layer 4, and it is responsible for the establishment of sessions. And in the general scheme of things, it is responsible for things like your packet sequencing and the sort of retransmission stuff, which tends to happen at the TCP level to ensure end-to-end reliability. The next level above that is the session layer, and it is responsible for controlling how many sessions are opened or closed at a particular state. So obviously if you open a connection to a website, you end up with an HTTP session or more, depending on the website, between you and the remote web server, and it is up to the session layer to deal with those sorts of issues. The presentation layer is responsible for things such as character set conversion. It is responsible for how the data is going to be presented by the user. So, for example, when you attach the photo of the cute kitten to your email, that picture is actually Base64 encoded so that it can travel through the mail system in plain text. And on the other end of the connection, you can then see, or the person who receives your email can then see the picture of the kitten. The application layer is the layer which all of the applications talk to. Things talk to the application layer. And then the data is obviously taken down through all of those seven layers, travels along the communications medium, and goes back up through all of those seven layers. So if we take the advantage, the example of the picture of the kitten and your email, Brian has decided that he needs to send a picture of his kitten to Pat. I have no idea why, but it will do for the example. So he takes a picture of the offending Moggy, and he attaches it to his email, and he tells the email application to send it over to Pat's computer because she has to see what this kitten looks like. The data is taken from the application. It is sent down through the application layer. It is then sent to the presentation layer. The presentation layer is responsible for encoding the data and make sure it is transmittable over the communications channel. The session layer is responsible for opening the connection from Brian's computer to his mail server, and then from that mail server across to Pat's mail server and stuff. And that is the session layer. The transport layer is responsible for resequencing all the packets and making sure that all of the bits of the kitten get from one end of the link to the other. The network layer is responsible for the addressing so that Brian's computer knows how to talk to his server, and his server knows how to talk to Pat's server, who knows how to talk to her computer. That is the network layer. The data link layer is responsible for the framing and stuff on, for example, the ADSL lines, on, for example, the frame relay links between these two people, and also on the local Ethernet between, say, Brian's computer and his modem. And the physical layer is responsible for all of the physical stuff, such as the voltages and how the bits are going to be sent over the particular wires. So, we start at the top of the model, as I said, we go application, we go presentation, we go session, we go transport, we go data link, we go network, we go... I got them around the wrong way, sorry, we go transport, we go network, we go data link, we go physical. And then whilst it goes to the other end, it goes back up the layers of the OSI reference model, starting at the physical, the data link, the network, the transport, the session, the presentation, and the application. And then when it finally gets to the application layer on the other side, Pat gets to see the picture of the cat, virtually speaking, okay? Any questions on all that? All right, there'll be a spot quiz next week on this. And we'll see how much you all remember. All righty, well, that's about the size of the stuff I've got for today's lecture until my notes turn up. So I think...
What happened to you?
I'm going to... They disappeared out of my Dropbox. They're not there. Exploration module 2 is missing.
That's really strange.
Yeah, so I don't know whether something has deleted them. I'm about to go back through the deletion history on the website and see where they went. But they're not there. And I had those notes because I was looking through them last week because I almost gave a lecture on the wrong set of notes last week. All right, anybody got any questions, queries before I hit stop on the recording? Okay, remember guys, we are doing the labs for chapter 1. I've got one or two in. You are doing the wiki lab, if you haven't already done it. You are doing the... you are doing the IRC lab, although you get to use a different instant messaging system and talk about the different instant messaging systems. And you guys are reading through the Google Earth lab, and these are the Chapter 1 labs.
I actually did attempt to have a peek at the Google Earth one. Apparently they've changed their layout, because I actually could not find the documentation page. And it's got to be there somewhere, but they moved it, and I couldn't sort of, by poking at links, come up with a definitive guide. What I was actually looking for was the sort of feature comparison list between the editions.
Okay. Well, the Google Earth Lab is optional. Basically, the difference between the editions is that the professional edition will allow you to connect a GPS receiver. It will allow you to do real-time mapping, and it allows the certain export of various map data and stuff into common map formats. But I can actually, you can actually, if you can't do the Google Earth Lab, it's not the end of the world. At least you've had a look.
Yeah, I mean, most of the rest of it looked doable. If I can find, you know, a definitive manual, because it talks about the mouse you know, some of it talks about the mouse movements and, you know, what happens if you do this with your right button. And since I can't play with it, I'll give it a shot, see if I can find it in the documentation.
Grace, can you just jump up to the lobby and see if Brian's alright? Ah, hello. There we go. Hello. We're just finished. Okay, no worries. Anybody else got any questions and queries before I hit stop? Because we've just finished the lecture.